Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. Our podcast for today is one that is going to be full of controversy and is one that I had been waiting for a while. It came published. I read through it as quickly as I could. I really thought about this in detail, came up with quite the blog post. So I don't know if you normally, when you're listening to this, go to the actual website, but please, please, please check on it this time because we did a lot with it and I'm going to keep working on it for a little while just to continue to improve it so you can actually see some more stuff. But it's all about the Paramedic 2 trial. If you don't know what the Paramedic 2 trial is, that's okay. But this is a trial that you need to know about. Whether or not you practice in the pre-hospital or in-hospital setting, you must know about this trial. I don't usually stress knowing one particular study, but in this case, this particular case, you need to know this trial. And actually, I'd highly encourage you and would recommend that you do this now if you've got the chance. And if not, at least look through it later. But please, before my bias is introduced to you, read the study. It is free. It is open access. If you need to, you can even go to the website. And we have a link, of course, in the show notes right at the top about where to go to read this study. But you really, 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 really should read this study before you really start injecting the opinions of others into your own thoughts. Because you may see things differently than I see things. And I think that's totally fine. In fact, I think that's the way we need to go, is to understand that there are some key differences amongst us and that we will have different viewpoints. And that is important. I want feedback from this. I need feedback from this. I want to know what everyone else is thinking. But for me, and as the title will suggest this, epinephrine in many ways may be, well, for lack of better words, dead, at least in the out-of-hospital cardiac arrest setting in most cases. There are, of course, exceptions to it, but I think we need to make sure that as we're moving forward, we keep this at least in the back of our minds, if not working on making some changes in the future. So what am I talking about? Why is this such a big deal? Why am I stressing this so much? Because most of our patients who go into cardiac arrest do so in the field. And when they come in and we start taking care of them, whether it's in the pre-hospital or in the ED or maybe even the ICU, wherever you end up being in the spectrum of things, we got to know the importance of the resuscitative measures that we're using. There's a lot of evidence about high-quality CPR, early defibrillation, but even though we have been doing this for a long time, epinephrine, the evidence for it is still weak. Like I've done before, and I even talked to my friend Ken Milne first to make sure that he wasn't going to just turn around and publish his own version, the same thing. It's going to be a little bit when I talk to him about it. I wanted to make sure to have kind of a detailed description of the study, a nice breakdown for people to review and see some of the different points that come up. So please check that out. You may notice if you look at the SGM, and I used to do this a lot more. I haven't been doing it recently. I even realized that I was going through and looking at stuff that I haven't done a detailed review of a single RCT for a while. So welcome back. We're going to do this and we're going to go through it fully. So as was mentioned, the title is Perkins et al., A Randomized Trial of Epinephrine in Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest, New England Journal of Medicine. And this was published July 18th, 2018. So this was super recent, within the last week, at least from the time I'm publishing this. So now, maybe a little bit further by the time you get a chance to download it, but this is one of the first podcasts out on this subject. I like to, in these cases, kind of go through a case just so we can get a feel. So you're called to the home of a 64-year-old female who suddenly collapsed after reporting chest pain to her spouse. Family called 911 and initiated bystander CPR while waiting for fire and EMS to arrive approximately 8 minutes later. After providing high quality CPR and defibrillating for ventricular fibrillation, ROSC has not yet been achieved. You, as the team leader, are starting to consider other measures, such as the use of epinephrine after administering that initial shock. So let's go through the background of this. We've already talked a lot about the background ahead of time, But it's worth acknowledging there's been a lot of debate about the risks and benefits of epinephrine, and there's been a demand for a large RCT, randomized control trial, regarding this subject. Epinephrine has been part of the cardiac arrest protocol since the 1960s. It's been around basically since the beginning. We like epinephrine for its alpha adrenergic effects, mainly constriction, including the aortic diastolic blood pressure being increased, which in turn will increase coronary blood flow because, again, that's a diastolic thing, not a systolic thing, if you kind of remember that from your anatomy and physiology. And it helps to increase the chances of ROSC, but we do impair microvascular blood flow in the process. And what this can do is this can lead to us having some other issues down the line, including impacting the cerebral cortex. So neurovascular intact survival can be affected here by those effects. Also, you got the beta adrenergic effects of epinephrine, which can cause dysarrhythmias, increase myocardial oxygen demand, and increase the risk of recurrent cardiac arrest. All these are big things, and this is just kind of brushing over some of the big parts we had to consider. There's even more to think about beyond that, such as the surge of catecholamines as you're doing this, especially in the bolus form and all that stuff, but we'll talk about that more in a minute. So the clinical question, is epinephrine beneficial in the treatment of out-of-hospital cardiac arrest? A simple question, but it's a little loaded, and we'll talk about that too. So let's start with our PICO. The population was adult patients who had sustained an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest for which advanced life support was provided by trained paramedics. This happened with the NHS in the UK. It's very much worth noting that early. But the exclusion criteria were patients with known or apparent pregnancy, age less than 16 years, cardiac arrest from anaphylaxis or asthma, or administration of epinephrine prior to arrival of a trained trial paramedic. So if they were not a trial-trained paramedic and they gave an epi ahead of time, that excluded them, basically. In addition, the London Ambulance Service also excluded traumatic cardiac arrest patients, which, again, makes sense because what do they really need? Probably not epinephrine. The intervention was 1 milligram of epinephrine as a bolus every 3 to 5 minutes with a total of 10 pre-filled syringes possible for delivery. That doesn't mean that they gave it. In fact, they usually gave far less than that, but they had that option of up to 10 rounds. The comparison was placebo of 0.9% normal saline with a total of 10 pre-filled and identical appearing syringes possible for delivery. Again, a really nice way to do that. It looks the same. Everything acts the same. Basically, it was numbers on the packaging that made the difference. And the outcome was the primary outcome of survival at 30 days. And this is not neurologically intact. What were the author's conclusions? Quote, in adults with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, the use of epinephrine resulted in a significantly higher rate of 30-day survival than the use of placebo, but there was no significant between-group difference in the rate of a favorable neurological outcome because more survivors had severe neurological impact in the epinephrine group, end quote. Like I said there, there's a lot to consider, and we're going to talk about this a lot more. But first, let's go through the quality checklist for randomized controlled trials based on the Best Evidence in Emergency Medicine, or BEAM, checklist. The study population included or focused on those in the ED. This is not directly for the ED, but these are still patients that we care about. These are ones that were done by EMS. They may or may not have been transported to us, but we still need to keep them in our minds. The patients were adequately randomized. Yes. The randomization process was concealed. Yes. The patients were analyzed in the groups to which they were randomized. Yes. The study patients were recruited consecutively, i.e. no selection bias. Yes, but a large set of patients were excluded because they had achieved ROSC prior to enrollment. And we're going to talk about that more here in a minute as well. The patients in both groups were similar with respect to prognostic factors. Yes. All participants, patients, clinicians, outcome assessors were unaware of group allocation. Yes. All groups were treated equally except for the intervention. Yes. Follow-up was complete? Yes. Actually, it was 99.9%. Pretty damn good. All patient outcomes were considered. Yes, but it was not the primary outcome. That's my argument. Yes, survival is a patient-oriented outcome, but more importantly, as we're going to discuss here very, very shortly, neurologically intact survival is really the one that patients care about. The treatment effect was large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant. No. Okay, let's talk about the key results. And it's a lot to unpack here too, but you don't have to keep track of all the numbers. All the numbers are on the website. But long story short, about 10,623 patients were screened for eligibility, for which 8,103 patients were randomized. That means the trial packs were opened, and of which 8,016 were enrolled into the trial. That means that the pack was open and the drug was administered. 4,015 patients received epinephrine, while 3,999 received the placebo. Only 7 total patients, so 3 from the epi group and 4 from the placebo group, were excluded from the primary outcome. 130 patients, so 3.2% in the epinephrine group and 94 or 2.4% in the placebo group, were alive at 30 days with an unadjusted odds ratio of survival of 1.39, a 95% confidence interval of 1.06 to 1.82, with a p-value of 0.02. The fragility index, for those who know what I'm talking about, if not, feel free to check out the website because I'm going to have links for that there, was 6. So fragility index of 6 for this trial. In regards to discharge from the hospital with a favorable neurological outcome, that's based on a modified Rankin scale of 3 or less, it was 87 of the 4,007 patients, or 2.2% in the epinephrine group, and 74 of 3,994 patients, or 1.9% in the placebo group, but was not statistically significant. This was an unadjusted odds ratio of 1.18 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.86 to 1.61. A modified Rankin scale of 4 or 5 was considered severe neurological impairment, and at hospital discharge, 39 of the 126, or 31% of the patients in the epinephrine group, had this versus only 16 of 90, about 17.8%, in the placebo group. All right, so now we've gone through all that stuff. This is my favorite part. These are the key points of debate. These are the things that we need to talk about. And I had a hard time narrowing it down to just a few things, and I actually have 10 different points that I want to talk about. Some of them are kind of related to others, as you'll see here in just a second, but let's get started. With the first part, this was a well-done study, and I do mean well-done. This was practically a flawless study for all things considered, and it was done in another country, but the guidelines are slightly different there. So what we need to keep in mind is in the UK, they'll follow the European Resuscitation Council's guidelines, or ERC guidelines, versus us, we're going to follow the ACLS protocol. And by us, I mean if you're in the United States. Obviously, if you're in different parts of the world, you may follow ERC versus ACLS. Whatever the case may be, there are a few subtle differences we need to keep in mind. For example, the ERC recommends epinephrine only after the third shock in shockable events, versus ACLS encourages it to be used no matter if it's a shockable or non-shockable rhythm. Given that there's been evidence that earlier epinephrine administration has improved ROSC, we should consider that there could be a potential difference in our management. However, the ERC does have some basis for this. There was actually a study published in the BMJ, the British Medical Journal, that earlier epinephrine after the first defibrillation had a decreased odds of survival. The average time to administration of the trial agent was approximately 21 minutes, which is most likely delayed enough that epinephrine may not have been as beneficial. And that partly could be how the study was designed, but also because of the ERC's guidelines. I think it's worth at least acknowledging that, although, as we'll talk about in a second, the shockable rhythm rate is a little lower, so it may not have had as a profound impact. But there has been enough of a suggestion with the 3 different phases of cardiac arrest, even if you extend the circulatory phase out to 15 minutes, more likely it's at that 4 to 10 minute mark, that this could play a role. Because epi given that late, about an average of 21 minutes, is much, much later than the circulatory phase. And for those of you who don't know the 3 phases of cardiac arrest, let's explain this real quick. So the first part's the electrical phase. So this is where early defibrillation really matters. This is about the first 4 minutes of cardiac arrest. This is where you're usually in that VFib or VTAC state. You can obviously be in that beyond those first 4 minutes, but that's where your best chance is of having true ROSC from early defibrillation alone. Most people are not going to be that fortunate unless they happen to be right next to an AED or whatever. Usually we're going to hit what's called the circulatory phase. And this is thought to be about 4 to 10 minutes into the cardiac arrest, generally speaking. And at this stage, this is where epinephrine may be at the most beneficial, because there's the idea of between high quality CPR and epinephrine, you could improve the odds of successful defibrillation, because at this point, the heart is otherwise globally ischemic. So even though you're shocking that heart, without sufficient CPR and possibly the use of certain medications such as epinephrine, you may not be able to get a successful defibrillation even after your attempts. Then after about 10, maybe 15 minutes, depending on what you look at, you get the metabolic phase of arrest. And at this point, this is when you have significant metabolic derangements and likelihood just starts dropping like a rock. Furthermore, though, you have to basically account for all these different things that can play a role in affecting your cardiac arrest management, and it becomes really difficult that even after you resuscitate someone, they still have a high risk of complications down the line because of a lot of these metabolic derangements. Another important point that ties in with this. This trial is specifically designed for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, and there are unique challenges to the pre-hospital environment if you're not thinking about this. It's not accurate to exactly extrapolate the results for in-hospital cardiac arrest, because usually most in-hospital cardiac arrests are in a monitored environment where patients usually have a quicker response. They usually have much easier access to early defibrillation, although a witnessed cardiac arrest in, say, an airport or casino is going to have great odds of survival too, because they're pretty much monitored. That's not always the case. That said, 11.5% of patients had a witnessed cardiac arrest by a paramedic. And as we'll explain more in a second, maybe that plays an important role. It would be nice to have had further data about whether or not those being witnessed arrests by paramedics made a difference in survival rates. And the reason why I say this all ties in, this kind of ties in nicely to my third point. Out-of-hospital cardiac arrest is kind of a misnomer in some ways. It's not really a misnomer. I mean, it's either in the hospital or out of the hospital, but is that necessarily the same thing? Let's think about this for a second. If you do not have a witness arrest by a medical professional, so if it was not part of that 11.5%, yes, that makes sense. Usually these people are in private settings such as their home, so they're less likely to have the benefits there of early defibrillation, and most likely not high quality CPR, at least not for a long time, because especially if you're living in a rural environment like I am, you may have a loved one who can do CPR for a while, but they probably can't do it 10, 15, 20 minutes. And especially if there's no access to defibrillation or any other measures, yeah, you're doing something, but it's an entirely different ballpark. Versus if you're witnessed by a medical professional, and what I mean by a medical professional, I mean someone who has the capabilities at hand. Just because you get witnessed, like say an EMT's at a restaurant where there's no AED, just because you see it doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to change how you manage that patient. Maybe you'll do a better job at your CPR and stuff like that, but beyond those types of things, you really are dealing with a different ballpark. So maybe we need to change what we call this. I know that's a big push to make to try and encourage something like that. But maybe we need to do non-witnessed by medical professional or NBMP versus witnessed by medical professional WBMP as far as how we differentiate cardiac arrest patients and their survival. Because I think, and I do stress I think, because I don't really know if there would be a difference. I'd encourage your all's opinions on this, how much that plays a role in the survival, because especially if you have immediate access to AED or other forms of defibrillation, or if you have multiple people who can provide high quality CPR or certain medications or treatments for reversal, yeah, that's going to really increase your odds, if nothing else. So I think we have to start thinking about that as being a different environment, especially when we think about in the hospital. This ties in to everything else. Just because you're in the hospital doesn't necessarily mean that in-hospital cardiac arrest has a better odds of survival. Because if you're in an unmonitored unit, such as a regular floor patient, you go into arrest, well, that's probably not going to help you out at all. You might as well be, in many ways, an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest patient if you're sitting there for 10, 15, 20 minutes before you've been discovered. A little kind of tying in here is that we don't know how this was managed in the hospital. So basically, there was no control beyond that. And I think it's worth kind of looking at this because most likely patients were treated the same by the NHS, especially if they're following ERC guidelines, which most likely they were. Everyone's following the same point. However, we have to keep in mind, people could have gotten epi at the hospital, even though they got the placebo in the field, and that could have played a role that may have increased survival in the placebo group. I really don't think that's a big deal, though, because when you look at the tables and when these people got transported, they're well outside the window where you could arguably say that epinephrine is really going to help these patients on their survival. Given the rest of the trial results, I don't think that this is going to have a major impact, but I think it's one that people need to at least consider, and I know it's brought up in the paper as well. The next point is that overall survival rates were low for those included in the study, and I do mean low. And I think I really know the big reason why on this, at least I think the big one that we need to focus on, is that 637 of the 2,607 patients that were excluded, so 24.4%, almost one out of every four patients, were excluded from the study because they achieved ROSC prior to enrollment. And that's a big number. When we think about overall the study, that means that 6% of the total patients in the trial obtained ROSC prior to the study enrollment. So when you're talking about, oh, well, there's only a 3% survival rate and everything else, like this is way low, they must have screwed something up. I really don't think they do, because when you start combining that and the other 6%, next thing you see here, guys, is that, no, this is pretty consistent with other high quality studies and agencies and everything like that. We just excluded the group that really didn't need epinephrine. They needed high quality CPR and defibrillation alone. So this helps take them out of the argument. I think that in some ways, this was a much better way to do the study. We just have to recognize that the overall survival rates for those in the study, those enrolled in the study, are going to be much lower than we normally anticipate. Which also ties into my next point, is that there was a low rate of shockable rhythms. Again, this makes sense. So yeah, there was about the same number of patients, only 770 or 19.2% in the epinephrine arm, and then 748 or 18.7% in the placebo arm had a shockable rhythm, which most of them were ventricular fibrillation. But again, this makes sense to me, because if they had a great shockable rhythm and they were shocked right out of it because of early defibrillation, then yeah, they didn't need anything else. And this also explains why there's a lower proportion of them. This again makes sense to me. And I don't find this any form of a limitation in this study. However, there is something I want to talk about now as my next point that is a limitation to the study that we have to consider. And that's the modified Rankin scale. I've talked about this before. There's a real potential for inaccuracy and subjectivity. And they decided to use their favorable neurological outcome as a modified Rankin scale of 3 or less. Other studies have done 2 or less. And I think it's worth acknowledging this, because in those two different looks, this changes one of the arguments that comes up in this trial. So with the modified Rankin scale of 3, epinephrine had a little bitty bit of improvement versus the placebo. It was 87 patients or 2.2% versus 74, the placebo at 1.9%. But if you change that cutoff to 2, which is an even better rate of survival, and realistically, I think an easier one to have as a cutoff because of some of the subjectivity with 3, then you actually see that epinephrine was worse at 52 patients or 1.3% versus 54 at 1.4%. Given 3 is not bad, but if I had the choice for 2, I'd much prefer 2. The real point of all this is that, you know, I don't think there's a really strong statistically significant difference either way. I mean, there wasn't a statistical significance in the study, but there wasn't even really a trend. You really have a hard time arguing that. So those who are listening, you say, well, there was a trend towards this way. Maybe a bigger study would have helped. I wouldn't agree with that, because again, you can flip it and say, well, modified Rankin scale 2, placebo was better. Okay, so we're rounding up this, and I think this ties in nicely with my next point. So although patients found neurologically intact survival as the most important outcome, this was not the primary focus of the study. They even asked people ahead of time, what do you find the most important part of survival? And they kind of broke it up into a few different categories, but essentially, neurologically intact survival was what people cared about the most. The actual patients who were going to be taken care of eventually, that's what they want. They want neurologically intact survival. They just don't want to be here. They want to be able to do stuff. And I think that's something that we have to keep in mind. So I know some people were really annoyed by this study because the primary outcome was survival at 30 days. And yes, you may have increased ROSC with epinephrine, but it doesn't change neurologically intact survival. That is a very valid point, and I agree. I wasn't very happy with the study about that until I thought about something. We already have the largest study. This is the largest study to date. And they still didn't have the power to do good neurological outcome as the primary endpoint because of how few people are going to survive with a good neurological outcome. It'd take far more people. It'd take much longer time. I think this trial is a great start, and I really doubt that we're going to find a statistically significant difference if we even tried to enroll enough people to make the power work, especially when we have subjectivity with the modified Rankin scale, that even if we do that, I mean, it's going to be hard to do it well unless we come up with a different scale, some way that is less objective and easier to score and maybe a little more dichotomous in nature so we can actually calculate some other things with. I think that is something that we really, really have to consider when we think about patients and this trial and what it means. This may be the best we get, at least in a very long time, quite possibly ever, especially if we abandon epinephrine in the near future, which ties in very nicely to the next point. I kind of thought about this, guys. I really, really want to make sure I got this right. Epinephrine is probably not the best drug or may not even be worth considering at all. But if we do, maybe it's all about the dosing. We've done higher dose epinephrine in the past. Yeah, they got even higher rates of ROSC than the current doses we use, but it did not change neurologically intact survival. And I think part of this is not just the dosing, but how we deliver the medicine. I think bolus dosing, it's not physiologic. And I had this conversation with people along with the rest of the study in my shop about how we saw this. I've talked with other people as well. And long story short, bolus dosing is pretty hard to do well. Like, you can slam it in, that's great, but that's not really what the body's meant to do. They're not meant to get surges. Like, basically, you're giving a strong adrenaline rush about every 3 to 5 minutes. What makes a little more sense is having that constant, steady state of delivery. And how you deliver that, you know, people like Scott Weingart have advocated for using arterial line. If you're working like me in a shop where you may only have one other person or maybe no one depending on the time of day, and a lot of us are working these small community EDs, throwing in an art line in the mix of things can be really tough to do. One thing I heard, which actually makes sense and helps you keep in track with the ACLS protocols if you're worried about violating ACLS protocol by not doing it this way, is at least start at 200 mics per minute. Well, if you're doing it over the course of 5 minutes and you're doing this on the routine, that's the same thing as you giving 1 milligram boluses every 3 to 5 minutes, but at least it's a little more physiologic. And I think that's something that could be a good compromise if you're worried about that. I think better would be to avoid epinephrine, or if you think you really need some sort of vasopressor support, maybe this is someone who is in profound shock versus someone who is like true pulseless electrical activity with no cardiac motion or an asystole type patient, maybe having a little bit of another type of pressor may be beneficial. And I thought about this quite a bit. I've talked to other people, seeing what their thoughts were on it too. Really, norepinephrine makes the most sense. You get more of the alpha with less of the beta, but you need the beta effect to a certain amount. So maybe the beta one works out a little bit better. I'd be curious everyone else's thoughts on this too. From who I've talked to, and actually I had someone who approached me several months ago asking about if I would consider using norepinephrine in the cardiac arrest patient. I really like the idea. I really do. But again, I think there are other things that are a bigger part, and it's really challenging because you have to have a lot of buy-in to go against or parallel to, in some ways, depending on how you look at it, with what is currently in ACLS or whatever your local guidelines are. So for me, I'm still having to do this, but I think the physiologic idea is a nice comprehensive way and kind of a fair way to do it for now. But I really believe that if you follow the ART line or something like that, maybe that could help, but we don't have the evidence for it yet. And really, when you think about it, we don't have great evidence for any of this use with epinephrine. Really, the next important point, the last important point that I have for these kind of key parts of the debate here, is that the number needed to treat for epinephrine was 112 in this study. That's pretty high. We talk about a lot of NNTs that are lower than that. Given there are a lot of NNTs that are even higher than that, but is that really the best thing? Probably not. What we really should focus on, as I mentioned at the very beginning, is high quality CPR and early defibrillation, because those types of things are what's going to really matter. And we can talk about these other things, and we should still look into them, but I think we really need to quit pushing the epidosing so hard and focus again on the big things. When you think about CPR performed by a bystander, number needed to treat for survival was 15. Early recognition of cardiac arrest, an NNT of 11. Early defibrillation, an NNT of 5. One out of every 5 patients. Again, we can talk about epinephrine all we want, but it's not going to be the key. That's not going to be the key to survival. We need to recognize that. So when we compare conclusions, although more patients will achieve ROSC with epinephrine out of hospital cardiac arrest, it does not lead to a significant increase in neurologically intact survival, which is the ultimate goal with our patients. So when it comes to the bottom line, epinephrine for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest should not routinely be used unless higher level evidence can demonstrate its benefits for improving a neurologically intact survival, whether that's even using a lower dose, more physiologic dosing, maybe not even actually using epinephrine and using norepinephrine, or just ditch it entirely. We need to know that there are limitations with epinephrine, and unless we can find something different, we really need to start abandoning this, at least for routine use. Again, maybe there may be a role in anaphylaxis and asthma and stuff like that. But otherwise, I think for the most part, we're seeing that this is going to be the death of epinephrine and that really there need to be some changes that happen. Again, we got to focus on the high quality CPR and the early defibrillation. And let's just see what happens down the line. So let's get back to that case. You know, that 64-year-old female cardiac arrest patient. After a quick discussion with your team, you all agree to focus on the CPR and defibrillation to try and reverse this. And on the next rhythm check, to get ready for that second defibrillation, you see an organized rhythm and someone has felt a palpable pulse. You got an increase in your CO2. So everything's going great. And you decide to immediately move on to post-resuscitation care and get this patient transferred to the closest facility. As far as the application, ROSC is going to be increased by epinephrine, but it's not the neurologically intact survival. And this is not the first study by any means. As the notes will show, there are lots of other studies that show the same thing. And so we really need to consider this when we talk about resuscitations in the future and help kind of push for change for our guidelines to quit advocating for routine use of epinephrine because it could be causing more harm in the end than we originally anticipated. So my favorite, what do I tell my patient? Well, I don't really tell my patient anything because they're resting. But when I'm talking to family, I'm going to explain to them that we're going to do the very best we can. We want to save your loved one. And what we're going to do is we're going to follow the best evidence and best science that we have right now. And that's the fact that we're going to continue to do the great CPR that you all have been doing. And we're going to shock them whenever possible. And we're going to focus on things that will help bring them back. Ultimately, as my conclusion with all this, because I've been droning on it feels like for a while, but I know I had a lot to talk about here. This is a popular subject right now. This is a very, very hot topic, and we need to recognize the importance of this because it is something that is going to directly impact practice, no matter where we're at in the in-hospital or out-hospital arena. Read the study so you can see this and come up with your own conclusions, but also check out some other people who've also posted things like Rebel EM, EM Nerd, St. Imlin's, First 10 in EM. All these people, plus so many more, I'm sure, are going to keep publishing stuff that we should just see what everyone's talking about and have a nice open discussion. If you like this stuff, please tell me. I'm more than happy to keep doing these things. As a quick little aside, I get lots of people And I've had quite a few recently who tell me how much they love the blog and the podcast. I enjoy that, and I really appreciate the positive thoughts. But there are a couple of things you can do. Please spread this to your colleagues. Please hit the share, the like, you know, retweet it, do whatever. Those are great ways to get it, but also just tell people in person. But something else, on iTunes, it's very easy for us to drop off the map, and that happens sometimes. What I'd like for you to do, if at all possible, it's very quick and very easy to do. Go to your iTunes, or if you're listening on other media, of course, do this on whatever other media, but give us a rating. If you don't think I'm good enough for a 5-star rating, let me know why, and I'll be happy to do what I can to fix that. But if you feel like we are good and we are doing great, please give us a 5-star review and actually add a little bit of comment to it as well, because that also helps. But please, the biggest thing is share this, and not just that way, just, you know, kind of help share the love and keep this moving forward. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.